Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
Communities stretching back thousands of years, vital natural resources, and fragile ecosystems. The Arctic's vast region is increasingly open to mineral exploration, cargo shipping, tourism, and even fisheries. As Russia, China, and other nations jockey for position in this warming landscape, who will ensure the safety of the people who call the Arctic home and protect the resources they depend on? And what will the U.S. role be? We'll discuss navigating the future of a rapidly changing Arctic today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello. From Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Is it hyperbole to say the eyes of the world are on the Arctic? It's safe to say the vast region of what was once nearly inaccessible, save for the indigenous communities who have lived there for generations, is experiencing rapid change. The Arctic Council reports there has been a 40% increase in vessel traffic since 2013, and as Russia builds up assets and partners with China on training exercises in the region, Arctic nations are banding closer together. What's known about the current and future security needs for Arctic communities, and what still needs to be determined? Our guests today spend a lot of time considering these needs. Retired Air Force Major General Randy Key is the director of the Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies, based at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, J-Bear, in Anchorage. And former Alaska Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell is a past chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and is a senior fellow at the Institute of the North. Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I want to give you both a bit of time to discuss your current work and the activities at the Center for Arctic Security. But first, Major General Key, NATO launched Arctic Sentry in February. And last Friday, a statement was released on Arctic security from what was called the Arctic Allies: Canada, Denmark, Greenland, the Faroe Islands, Finland, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, and the U.S. What is Arctic Sentry, and who are these solidarity statements aimed at?
Well, Lori, thank you, and thanks for taking the time to have a hopefully an important discussion today about the dimensions of Arctic security and defense. It applies to Alaska, certainly applies to our country, and certainly within the context of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. When you look at the reflections of Arctic Sentry, it is an opportunity for the practitioner community to advance their professional understanding, the professional competencies, and also signal the strong unity of effort within NATO to deter and dissuade those who would compete and challenge the sovereignty of the nations that are under the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which today numbers 32 nations. And within that 32-nation alliance, seven of those nations are Arctic nations: Finland, Sweden, Norway, the Kingdom of Denmark, which includes Greenland and the Faroe Islands, Iceland, Canada, the United States. Within opportunities such as NATO's Arctic Sentry and other sort of NATO exercises, it's an opportunity not only for just the seven of nations with their Arctic nation within NATO, but also NATO as force structures and 32 contributing members, nations that contribute defense measures to be capable to defend NATO's interests across, if you will, the northern flanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for getting us started there, sir. Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, your thoughts on these public-facing statements. Part of Friday's release said, "Today we have agreed to deepen our dialogue on security challenges in the Arctic and the high north." What does that say to you, deepen the dialogue?
You know, I think because there have been some discussions about Greenland, that the NATO
discussions?
Alliance... I'm just going to say discussions. Okay. And I was involved in when I was chair of the Arctic Commission, I was involved in a U.S. Arctic policy that didn't mention Greenland, but we did a number of things specifically after that to build better relations with Greenlanders, okay? And I would say that from my experience both in as an advisor, a voluntary position at the Stevens Center, and as a businessman, that we are working together to make sure that's not a point of contention between us. And the fact that the allies have said it's far more important to look at external threats like Russia and China, and that we've got to work together and that we've got an interoperability challenge. We don't have enough icebreakers right now. The Canadians have got some. The Finns have got some. We have allied radars. So we have radars in Greenland and radars in Alaska that are essential to the defense of 700 million people in Europe and and North America. We've got to keep that alliance going. It's incredibly important. So I think that reaffirmation is there. I'm also aware that in the programs that General Keyes, running at the Stevens Center, the allies have been getting together all the time to figure out how to make things better.
Well, I want to drill down on that just a little bit, Major General Key. Another part of the statement notes enhanced military and surveillance as well as collaborative training in the Arctic. And this part, it says, with new opportunities open up and new challenges emerging, close cooperation on Arctic security and economic development among our nations is more important than ever as Europe and Canada are assuming a greater responsibility for deterrence and defense across the region. Is this a reflection or a realization of the sort of frosty relationship that President Trump has with NATO and his musings about seizing Greenland? The NATO allies, do they see the U.S. as a less dependable partner?
Lori, you're hitting on something that I would like to focus on something that perhaps is not covered in the press. And this is really how the practitioner community, that's essentially policymakers, folks that are in the business of actually conducting operations and those military structures that support allied security and also allied defense. This practitioner community operates below that level of that of politics, which is where I have the privilege of serving still in at the Stevens Center and how we support practitioner-focused security and defense, education, research analysis, and engagement and outreach. When you look at this alliance structure today, that in context of this recent declaration that came out from essentially the A7 that we listed earlier of NATO's within of Arctic allies within NATO, this is really an affirmation or reaffirmation of the importance of this practitioner level of interoperability, of being able to be providing proficiency and readiness training, educational activities, and more to ensure what I think was the most important aspect of this equation, well-prepared defenders of the cross, essentially our northern flanks, within a NATO context. So from my vantage point, staying out of the political aspects and getting to where stuff is real, and the really being able to contend with the facts that are on the ground across the region. We do our best, and we are externally focused, how we work together side by side, shoulder to shoulder, platforms that are interoperable with each other across this alliance to signal our determined resolve that this deterrence must maintain strong capabilities in order for us to defend and uphold all the 14 articles of the Washington Treaty that really undergird what NATO is today.
All right. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about the future of Arctic security with our guest today, retired Air Force Major General Randy Key, who is the director of the Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies at JBEAR, and former Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, who is a past chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and is a senior fellow at the Institute of the North. Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, you were appointed chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission 20 years ago, 2006. Describe what the focus was at that time, and then flash forward two decades to what the current concerns are and how they compare and contrast.
Well, if you go back to 2006, which is just 20 years ago, we were I would say constructive friends with Russia and with China, all right, where China was seeking entry as an observer in the Arctic Council. We brought Japan in. We were not going to bring in China without Japan, so we built relations there. Church and I have both served on the General Keyes Handleless Church. So if I call him that, that's what's going
just
on
so
there.
Just so folks know.
Yeah. The Arctic Research Commission has looked at several things where we really have to get pan-Arctic information on permafrost or on fish or any number of things in the meteorological area, so that we're working together. And that era has kind of come to a pause, obviously with Ukraine, obviously with China's emergence as a greater power. And it's causing some challenges in the Arctic right now that we didn't really anticipate 20 years ago. I'll give you one. The Arctic collaborators were very proud of the fact that we put we foreclosed shipping in the Central Arctic or fishing in the Central Arctic Ocean and said, let's study the fish. That has ended up to be a gold-plated invitation to China to send lots of ships to the Central Arctic Ocean, which may have military capabilities as well as research capabilities. I was in China aboard a Chinese icebreaker a few years ago, and one of the leaders of their Polar Research Institute, I said, people think you have submarines going under this icebreaker when you go to the Arctic. And he laughed, and he said, we don't have Arctic-capable submarines. And then he said, yet. Mm-hmm. And a couple of weeks later, Vladimir Putin arrested one of the scientists who was at the same conference, maybe for selling Russian Arctic submarine secrets to the Chinese. So if you take a look at that, where in a peaceful world, we would be fishing together, we would be managing our fish together, we'd be doing science together. But in a threatening world, it's just quite guarded. And so we've gone from trying to build those alliances to being very wary of those. Alliance is probably the wrong term, but building cooperation to being wary of cooperation.
Well, sticking with you, sir, for a moment, 7 years ago this month, you gave testimony to a U.S. House subcommittee on Coast Guard and maritime transportation for a hearing titled The Cost of Doing Nothing, Maritime Infrastructure Vulnerabilities in an Emerging Arctic. You were testifying as co-chair of the Polar Institute within the Woodrow Wilson Center, and you offered three ways of addressing needs in the Arctic. Describe what you suggested, and do you see the U.S. moving fast enough toward those ideas 7 years later?
Not fast enough, but we're getting there. I think, it's interesting. On the Arctic policy, President Bush did not want to use the word icebreakers in the policy because he was afraid, or his staff was afraid, that we would be committing to large new expenditures that OMB hadn't signed off on. It took Barack Obama almost 8 years to say the word icebreakers as a need for the country. And he said it here in Anchorage on that famous trip he made here.
Why was that such a hot-button issue?
Because most of our heavy icebreakers had been, built in 1970 and been one's being used for spare parts for the other. We have the Healy, which was which is newer, but not as heavier capability. And there was just an argument. These things are basically platforms for science. Do we need such expensive platforms for science? Because when I became chair of the commission, we actually had a meeting out at the Alaska Command. And Skeet Frazier was the head of the Alaska Command at the time. And he said, Meade, I'll have this meeting with respect for you, but I don't think we have any equities in the Arctic. And after we went through what's happening with sea ice and what's happening with greater accessibility, he said to me after the meeting, he said, I take back everything I said 6 weeks ago when we planned this meeting. And his planners called back and they joked, on the Al Gore phrase, they called it an inconvenient task to plan military work in the Arctic. But we now realize we've got a much more accessible coastline.
So in that time period, was it more politically untenable because people just didn't understand that we are an Arctic nation because of Alaska and that there are growing needs in that region? There just wasn't enough being talked about?
And I have to say, the people who represented us in the Senate and my in the House, I was speaking in a House committee in that time. I've probably testified for icebreakers more than anybody alive. And we now finally have had President Trump laid out a large number of icebreakers that we need. President Biden backed it up. We have this amazing agreement with Finland and Canada to help build the first ones. And we're moving forward. So yes, we're finally getting there. As Churchill said, Americans do the right thing after exhausting the other possibilities.
One more question before I move back to Major General Key. In those 2019 remarks, you said the U.S. should create a business, an Arctic Seaway Development Corporation modeled on the St. Lawrence Seaway, to bring nations together to offer a tariff-based service that will attract and justify infrastructure investment. Describe what you want to see there.
Sure. And in fact, you ask if we've been moving fast enough. Senator Murkowski, Senator Sullivan proposed a law, it was called the SEAL Act, that would actually create that corporation. Congress in 2020 said, let's do a feasibility study first. The Biden administration did not seat people on that feasibility plan. And recently we had Steve Carmel, who's the new head of MARAD, who's going to go forward with that study. So we'll see what happens. But think about it this way. If you are a container ship owner and you're trying to plan, are you going to use the Arctic Sea Route in 20 years? You want to know, are there icebreakers available? If the Arctic were an isthmus, we could say we could put in a canal and charge a tariff. The United States doesn't charge a tariff for icebreaker support we have in the Great Lakes or for others. We pay for it out of port taxes. But Canada charges a tariff. Finland charges a tariff. And so the concept is...
Is Russia doing that?
And Russia charges $500,000 a voyage to escort your ship through the Northern Sea Route. So the question that we have to ask as allies in the A7 is, do we want Russia to be the monopoly ship services provider in the Arctic? Or do we want to set up a business that maybe helps pay for these ports in Nome and Port Clarence and Cape Blossom and... Up in the high Arctic of America that we need, that pays for the mapping and the charting, and that pays for the icebreakers. And the Russian business plan on this said, and again, this was written in a peaceful time, they said that the pairs, mostly between Europe and Asia, would take about 10% of the traffic out of the Suez Canal. And that's 1,800 ships a year at 500,000, so that's a $900 million business, okay? A $900 million business that we should give the Russians a monopoly? I don't think so. Somebody said to me before I gave that testimony that day, you know, why should Americans pay for icebreakers so China can sell goods more efficiently to France? And I said, well, we have Anchorage Airport right now, the Ted Steams Airport, largest air cargo port in the country, and a large part of all those carriers are helping Asians sell goods to Europe. But we're making the money, we get the jobs. So either from an economic standpoint, from a presence standpoint, which is very important for security, we should be prepared for Arctic shipping to come. And this is one of the arguments, Laurie, that I make quite a bit. If you know what the military needs in terms of, you know, better fiber optics for our radars or intelligence or that sort of thing, work between the military and the civil community. If they need ports and fuel, we need ports and fuel. If they need better telecommunications, we need better telecommunications. And Canada wasn't with us on missile defense when we got it started. We would have probably had a fiber across the Arctic then if they were part of the deal, because we're closer to that base in Greenland than New York is where the fiber comes in. Or I'm not sure if it's New York, but East Coast. So my point here is, if we look at Arctic economic integration, as that NATO statement said, pay attention to the business aspect, and we're going to have a much more secure Arctic.
All right. Thank you so much. And Major General Key, I want to turn back to you. If you have any follow-up that you'd like to add, I certainly would love to hear that. Otherwise, I've got some questions about the Security Center work.
But well, please. Thank you. Well, Laurie, first of all, thank you. And you can welcome to call me Church. Most folks do.
I cannot do that, sir.
Okay. A couple things I just offer in compliment to Governor Treadwell's reflections. Number one, when you look about allied strength when it comes to, you know, securing and defending our respective national interests across the region, you have to look at it, you know, holistically. There is obviously the community of diplomacy. Obviously, the statement you just read earlier from Friday was a diplomatic statement affirming our shared commitments under the principles of the Washington Treaty from 1949. The next piece, of course, is the informational aspects, you know, how we share and really level the bubbles between allies and our understanding of the informational environment. The next piece, of course, is our respective military strength and the strength of our armed forces and forces that support. It's not just the folks that are in uniform, but it's really a whole community of practitioners that support our allied and national interests when it comes to matters of defense. And then lastly, perhaps the one most important thing of the conversation when you think about investing for the future is the business about economies. Today, if you look at the allied Arctic, you look at the Nordic regions where economies have really built a tremendous amount of infrastructure that enables commerce, that enables essentially a thriving industry. If you look at North America's Arctic regions, when I talk about that, I include Greenland, the high north of Canada, and Alaska. Our economic strength is yet to be realized to any substantial level when you compare and contrast to our allies in the European theater. This is where the benefit of our natural resources is one part of the equation. The amount of mineral wealth, the amount of natural wealth, ultimately should be looked at as smartly and sustainably harvesting this to our respective economic benefits. The other piece of this, of course, is in addition to the natural wealth, is the transportation. And Governor Treadwell hit this correctly. When you look at a trans-Arctic versus a northern sea route or a northwest passage as lines of commerce, it could be, again, based on cables and you know, the communication information on seabed cables. And someday in the future, as you look at the impacts of a diminishing ice Arctic, specifically when you look at the reduction of volume and size of the cryosphere, specifically aspect of 1 year versus multi-year ice, that is really hearkening the aspect that a transpolar route is feasible within the century, arguably within 20 years, maybe less. Strategically, if you look at the lines of commerce on maritime traffic, where you if you're looking north to the shorter distances of Great Circle routes, that's the reason why it's much shorter going north or south than across the fatter middle part of the planet. If you look at this now, today you have the aspects of really limited draft. When you look at the Northern Sea Route off of the Eurasian coast versus and also Northwest Passage, even shallower waters, the only place you have unlimited draft is really a transpolar route. And so new vessels being constructed now are more in the 50, 60-foot draft range. That's far deeper than you can ply going through the Northern Sea Route and certainly the Northwest Passage. So strategically, diplomatic, informational, military, economics work together to provide essentially that corporate package, federated package, if you will, of what it means to secure our national and allied interests in this region. The defense part of the equation is just one part, but you can't achieve these other elements unless you have a strong allied effort to really deter adversaries from taking negative action against our interests.
Makes sense. Sticking with you, Major General Key, before we take a break here at the bottom of the hour, give us some insight into the work of the Ted Stevens Arctic Security Center. The third volume of the Journal of Arctic Security was released by the center this spring. What is the focus there?
Well, thank you. First of all, it's a privilege to rejoin you, to give you this is the third chance as the shepherding elder for the Stevens Center to visit with you about the work that we're about. This is actually, for us, we turned five this summer. On the 9th of June, 2021, at the time, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced the establishment of the center based on a congressional appropriation and authorization provided through the National Defense Authorization Act of 2021. The center joined back in the summer of 2021 five prior established centers. That first goes back to the George C. Marshall Center for European Security Studies, located in Garmisch-Partenkirchen in Germany, which was established after the Cold War, built in the spirit of the Marshall Plan that was reconstruction of Europe after the Second World War. After the end of the Cold War, looking at how could we in the West, and NATO at the time, could bring for the former Warsaw Pact nations into more of a NATO orbit and the NATO alliance. Strategically, that center was established to do the same three authorities in Congress, established by Congress, that exist for the other five: education, research analysis, and engagement outreach. At the time, they were focused mostly on education and bringing the members within the Ministry of Defense and the Armed Forces into kind of a NATO understanding. I was a C-130 pilot flying aircraft commander back in the day in 93 when the Marshall Center was established. I was flying out of Rhein-Main Air Base West in Germany. Almost said West Germany. Back in the day, it was West Germany, but strategically, the NATO at that time was 17 allies strong. Today, NATO is at 32. The Marshall Center can rightly say, with more than 16,000 graduates of their program, that they contributed to the expansion of the alliance, I think it's rightly said. The Stevens Center builds into that legacy of the prior five centers, like each other one is tailored uniquely for the region where it serves. For us, of course, you're not going to be able to, conduct, you know, security and defense operations in the Arctic unless you understand the physical environment. So we look at the standpoint of the center that our job is to really prepare practitioners, security and defense through education, research analysis, and engagement outreach from geophysical to geostrategic. So you hit all these different facets of the operational environment, contending with logistics concerns, operational risks, the operational environment, aspects of lawfare, and also the legal environment. And then also, most importantly, really, how do you find ways to reduce risk? Strategic risk, all the way down to tactical. So risk is something we think about when you operate in the Arctic. You're contending with a risk from the moment you go out the door to try to conduct your particular mission. For us, accounting for that risk, reducing that risk, and finding alternative ways to get the job done while minimizing the risk equation is part of this, of the science, if you will, that we bring to the table. Next thing, and I'll just bring this to close till you give me the hook. We started the center with the idea of focusing on fundamentals. Today, though, we are structured our center, again, in accordance with the authorities provided by the Congress, the School of Arctic Security Studies. Today, we bring 10 courses to bear. We were born during COVID, so we started with the online activities. And today, at the Stevens Center, we have a studio. And that studio is really the hub of how we bring the practitioner community, U.S. and allied, together in different course offerings. And our educational courses now really span that geophysical to geostrategic. On the research analysis side, you've just highlighted the Journal of Arctic Security. That's just one of our publications. We have a number of operational analysis, a number of executive briefs, and every time we convene an event, there is a report conducted of that activity. Today, the center, as we get ready to turn five this summer, 10 courses, more than 40 publications that the Research Analysis Division has provided. And then complementing that is really the what we call Strategic Engagement Division that conducts essentially a series of structured dialogues and field programs to bring people together to think through the strategic challenges, operational challenges, the tactical challenges, and try to find ways to get unity of effort and shared understanding. One other piece to this for us is that with the engagement division, we have essentially regional security dialogue structured essentially from what I call the Arctic Pacific, North American Arctic, Transatlantic, and the high north of the European theater. Essentially, you span different perspectives from the Bering Straits to the Russian-Finnish border east of Rovaniemi. Today, these engagement activities are structured according to that building block approach with a flagship program in the fall called the Anchor Security Defense Dialogue that we conduct downtown at the Hotel Captain Cook. Again, invitation-only activity, but for us, an opportunity to bring essentially that more senior-level perspective to these regional security building blocks.
Well, thank you for that. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue our discussion about the future of Arctic security as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today, we're talking about the future of the Arctic, Alaska's Arctic, and security in not only our region, but in the regions of our Arctic allies and other NATO members. In the studio with me today is retired Air Force Major General Randy Key. Major General Key is the director of the Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies at JBEAR. And also in the studio is former Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, who is a past chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and is a senior fellow at the Institute of the North. So I wanted to ask about, Major General Key, military leaders in Alaska haven't said much publicly about what the future buildup plans for Alaska may or may not be. The military closed ADAX base in 1997, but there has been discussion of possibly reopening some or all of that base. There's also work being done toward building a deep water port in Nome. Are you studying or involved in working on these specifics, these places?
Short answer is yes, of course. here's why, though. Strategically, the community, with the Department of War, it obviously sees the need to ensure that we are prepared and have a well-prepared force and force structure to accomplish the deterrence mission. And this, of course, is within the Department of War, but also should give a shout-out to our colleagues in the United States Coast Guard. So when you look at the security environment, there is a need for the armed forces of the United States to be able to operate into this region in order to, that in itself, a well-prepared practitioner force can contend with this, the, both a tactical and operational environment. And that in itself provides the ability to not only respond when, for example, long-range aviation from Russia approaches our air identification zones, but also be able to say today is not the day to really mess with the United States or the alliance. We are essentially, if you look at the Bering Straits, on NATO's northwest flank. When you think about the flanks of the alliance, they really extend from the Black Sea to the Baltic to the Barents, across the Circumpolar North to the Beaufort, Chukchi, Bering, and into the North Pacific. Most folks don't realize how important the, those 14 articles of the Washington Treaty are in this aspect about allied defense. The United States, as an Arctic nation, has put a lot of investments for that really involved defense of our homeland. And in this aspect, when you look at places like Ericsson Air Base out on Shimmy Island, ADAC, essentially the bottom end of the Aleutian chain, if you will, on that arc, but then also force structure within, you know, mainland Alaska, when you think about the base structure here at Joint Base Omidorff-Richardson, Eielson Air Force Base, Wainwright, you look at Fort Wainwright, you're looking at the aspect of the force structure and the infrastructure that goes with this, the establishment of the, you know, we have now more fifth generation fighters than anywhere else on planet Earth. We actually have one of the nation's two airborne divisions. Obviously, the story at 82nd down at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And here, of course, the 11th Airborne Division, a full division, an airborne division to be able to operate into the Pacific, but also conduct operations in the Arctic region. Those two elements alone, the, within the 11th Air Force, the fighting force structure there, the security defense aspects, when we think about essentially the interceptors and the radar sections that actually provide against ballistic missile attacks, ballistic missile attacks against our nation. Strategically, this is also the place of the NORADs, Alaska NORAD region, that is really a Canada-U.S. activity that really is trying to monitor and again, provide that deterrence picture and responding to threats that come across essentially to our northwest flanks.
And Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, I know that you had also mentioned some, you know, this larger build-out or other activities that are happening.
Yeah, so our delegation has procured over $100 million this year to help warm up ADAC. A lot of that money is going through the Denali Commission. It went to the Navy. It's going to the Denali Commission. So you're seeing some very basic things there. Perhaps, you know, in the way that a business park might work, only for different services. You may find some special ops work going on there. You may find some Navy work going on there and so forth. It's going to be very interesting to see. Church, I don't know if you wanted to add something on that one, but
I would. So first of all, as we play a little ping pong here, Lori, I hope you're
fine.
Okay with that.
That's absolutely fine.
If you look at ADAC today, and so years ago, before I went to the Air Force in the 1984-85 timeframe, I was on the working for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and as an engineering technician at Elmendorf back in the day. At the time, the 1980s was during the Reagan buildup, and we were trying to essentially replenish 1940s and 50s infrastructure out of ADAC in the day with 1980s. Mm-hmm. The 1980s edition has kind of fallen apart. And so perhaps when you the most important thing is you look at the $115 million that was procured through the One Big Beautiful Bill that went to the Navy, now has been moved to the Denali Commission to really get the lights on, really get the studies advanced to take a look at what do you need today. Right. You need, of course, a functioning airfield. And there is the basic runway infrastructure, but you need hangar space. You need to revitalize the fuel areas. Essentially, the logistics that enable airplane operations, that actually has got to pretty much go back to ground zero and build up. perhaps one of the best things they could do at ADAC and maybe take a scrape everything down to pavement and get all the infrastructure out and get that out, all that stuff that's kind of fallen in disrepair out there. But the $115 million gets us started. But it's a multi-year, multi-budget appropriation to build out. It's what I would consider perhaps the most important thing is an expeditionary size capability there that can enable airplane operations, whether it's maritime patrol, whether you're taking advantage of the location versus great circle route from east, from East Asia to North America. But it is a place that has got it's a fantastic zip code for its geostrategic location. And that in itself is worthy of defense.
All right, let's go to the phones for just a moment. Ethel is in Soldotna. Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
We are well.
I'm really glad to hear about Church and Meade Treadwell being on this show because, and their discussion is really fascinating. But I was really curious to hear from them about what they think about how long and how many decades of experience the Russians and the Chinese have had in coordinating their military and scientific research expertise into like coordinated functions, whereas the Americans for decades cabined their science and their military defense perspectives into two rather segmented areas. And the reason I ask that is because when I was working in the North Slope Borough during the oil and gas exploration and quarrelsome days, when we looked at Canada's approach, even Canada's approach seemed to be way more integrated than ours was. But when I looked at, especially at the Russian oil and gas explorations and how many commercial enterprises were connected with them in the far north, and when I read about the increasing excursions of the Russians into underwater near Norway, or their increasingly brazen interruptions of American airspace, It just seems to me that the Americans' approach has been really rather peripatetic. So I'm really glad to hear of the multi-year, multifaceted approach. I'll hang up and listen to both the individuals on my radio. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Ethel. And Ethel, before the break, General Key was talking about the Stevens Center, and I will tell you that when we were redrawing the lines of combatant commands in the world because of the changes in the Arctic in 2010, I had a conversation before that with Senator Stevens saying, can we get those guys in Garmisch, Germany, and those people at the what's now the Inouye Center in Hawaii to at least think about the Arctic together once? And Ted said to me, I think we ought to have our own center for the Arctic, and that's why I'm so happy to be with Church today and actually as a volunteer chair of their economic and energy group. I'm doing more of that than with the Institute of the North right now. But anyway, to her point, there's a couple things to remember. First off, we have a very strong ally in Asia, in Japan, and a second strong ally in Korea. And believe it or not, they are very attentive to what's going on in the Arctic. We had the former foreign minister of Japan here a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. She's been a friend for 20 years and has run an Arctic caucus, a polar caucus in the Japanese diet. And so they are very attentive to what's going on in Arctic security issues as we speak. When you talk about the Russian bear bombers, for example, they're not your. They may be the same Cold War bear bombers, but they are carrying a very different kind of weapon today. They're carrying cruise missiles. And those cruise missiles are essentially fast-flying aircraft. They're essentially drone aircraft. And so the number of fighter jets that we have here are probably going to stay here as long as that cruise missile threat, they're the best response to the cruise missile threat. And sadly, we've seen huge fuselage of cruise missiles in the Middle East wars that have been going on and in Ukraine. And shooting them down with airplanes is basically all we have to do right now. You've got hypersonics that may come along. We may be part in Kodiak of testing some hypersonics things. I'm not sure what's going to happen there. And this is one place where the Department of War has been fairly closed-lipped about the next generation of missile defense. We have, so whether it's drones or cruise missiles or continued ballistic missiles, Alaska is going to play a big role there, and that is integrated with Canada. It is integrated with NATO now, and it is integrated with the with our allies in Asia. So that integration that a caller was saying wasn't happening is happening more.
And would you say, yeah, General Key, that that's part of the work of the
right.
Ted Stevens Center is to bring together science and military considerations.
Laura, you're absolutely right. And I want to thank Ethel for the call as well. So in this business today, obviously, when we think about like the science technology part of the equation versus the operational capabilities of when you compare and contrast Russia and China versus that of what I'd call the NATO practitioner tradecraft. Russia and China may be operating in the vicinity of each other to have, quote, a combined effect, but they are not interoperable forces. NATO is fully interoperable. The Arctic 7 within NATO, perhaps exquisitely so. So that's on the real capability side and the skill of operational maneuver. Now, if you look at the science technology part of the equation, this is where the community of science can work in partnership with the defense industrial base of our country. And the defense industrial base is really moves at the speed of business, which usually outpaces the speed of government. So the DIB, if I use that shorthand, is really advancing what our Secretary of War has called for, the arsenal of freedom, by making, if you will, next echelon investments in military capability. This is why it's perhaps wise for the department to not all be all that sharing. If you use the ancient perspective, loose lips sink ships.
Right.
We don't want to play our hand by any stretch. And I'm privileged to serve within the Department of War as a senior servant, a civil servant. In this context today, government working in partnership with the defense industrial base to provide next generation technologies that leapfrogs our ability to stay ahead of the threat. You never want to fight, if you will, the last war. You're really trying to anticipate the hope of the war that never comes. But one of the best ways to prevent it from ever coming is presenting capabilities and fielding a force that the average say today is not the day to mess with us because we're too capable and it would hurt them too much.
All right, we are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll talk about what that future might look like in the Arctic as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We have in the studio today retired Air Force Major General Randy Key, who is the director of the Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies at JBEAR, and former Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, who is a past chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and a senior fellow at the Institute of the North. In February, a New York Times reporter went with members of the 11th Airborne Division to the Yukon Training Center, an area near Fairbanks, to train soldiers for combat in 40 below conditions. Beyond testing equipment and weapons in extreme cold, officials wondered how soldiers from Alabama, California, Texas, and Florida would fare. About 4,000 soldiers participated, including members of the ABLE Company, under the command of Captain Trong Duo Vo. I spoke with Captain Vo last week.
The weather conditions up here will actually have effects on you in an expedient manner. Not just like over time, hey, I feel kind of cold. It's like if you're in negative 40 and there is rotary wash from a helicopter, if you're not geared up or if you're not dressed in the appropriate uniform, it will actually make you lose fingers and toes, or it will actually kill you.
Army leaders wanted to know how far troops could go and engage in mock battles before they lost focus, made mistakes, or quit. Captain Vo said there's no way to tell someone what below zero will feel like. It must be experienced. They go through indoctrination training, sleeping out in negative 20 degrees. But Captain Vo says a learning moment for him was realizing how quickly in extreme cold people got demoralized.
I've been in the military long enough to know, like, when the sense of fatigue hits in. And I'd be like, I even guessed it, I was like, maybe it would be like the second or third day, like, we'll get this fatigue feeling, and I'll need to rejuvenate the guys with either rest, with words, whatever it is. No, it was like we were just crossing the river and they were already hitting the demoralization parts. And I was like, we're not even 1/19th of the way there yet. So that showed me that I had to change my leadership style to meet that kind of quickness to how fast this environment can change your mental state of mind.
Major General Key, the Middle East has been the focus for the Pentagon for a couple of decades at least. Will the next ground wars likely be fought in Arctic conditions?
I sure hope not. But let me offer a few reflections, I think, that builds on the captain's reflections. First of all, let me qualify. I'm a former Air Force pilot. I spent the bulk of my life flying operations or commanding those who do a lot around planet Earth, including the Arctic region, but also in the aspect of operating in the Arctic, both prior to going in the Air Force with the Army Corps of Engineers, but also more importantly, through 3 decades of airplane operations that included Arctic operations. This is about mental toughness. I look at the aspect, and history teaches a really important lesson why it's important for 11th Airborne Division and other military maneuver units to operate in the Arctic under winter conditions. I salute General Cogbill and his team, 11th Airborne Division, for making the focus of their winter training at JPMRC, and that's an acronym I'll unpack later, but let's just use a shorthand, Arctic tactical maneuvering and training environments in north of the Alaska Range, south and east of Fairbanks. Strategically, this mental toughness is how you enter the equation. And I look at the 1939-1940 Finnish-Soviet War as a classic textbook of how one side, being Finland, were able to hold off a substantially larger force of Soviets to essentially negotiate a truce, and ultimately it cost Finland some, but it cost the Soviet Union dearly. It was a mismatch because the Finns were Arctic tough. They also denied the Soviets essentially the needs for the means for them to continue their advance by denying soldiers a place to get rest, a place that is warm, and a hot meal. You essentially attack their psychology, and if you demoralize a soldier, you make that soldier an ineffective fighting tool. The Finns learned this during that war and ultimately were able to save their country despite the overwhelming odds that showed they should have been rolled up within a few days. The lessons learned, they're important for tactical organizations like the 11th Airborne Division to realize that if you can seize the initiative by taking the fight to the enemy's logistics hubs, their supply lines, their chow tents, sorry for the old hand terms, but strategically you deny those soldiers those basics, fundamentals, if you will, Maslow's basics, you essentially can negate a much more substantial force while you preserve and protect your own. But the other piece of this is the overwhelming nature of the operational environment. Minus 40 is cold. Minus 60 is unbelievable cold. The wind itself makes a huge difference on the ability for the soldiers to stay in the fight. When I compare and contrast, and I have the privilege of going routinely to JPMRCs during, they have visitation days every year, and I've seen different Arctics play out just in the different seasons. This year was all about serious cold temperature and a serious amount of snow. I mean, like 3 feet worth of snow, and trying to negotiate that, especially if you're on snowshoes or on skis, try and pull yourself on a sled. Whew, that is hard for this individual soldier to contend with. But the previous year was what's warmer temps, but an overwhelming wind. And how that wind itself was number one, negating the technology. The technology, for example, battlefield surveillance was ineffective because the winds were too strong for the platforms. If you launched a drone, it would be found in Canada because the winds were so strong. So you have to deal with the environment that presents itself. Mm-hmm. Resiliency means you're prepared for that environment. Your kit, if you will, is capable to contend with it, but it starts with education and mental toughness.
And yes, Mr. Treadwell, Lieutenant Governor, we only have a few minutes left. Please,
I'm just going to add one thing. You know, General Key's deputy director is Craig Fleener, who I've worked with. He was in our administration. He yes. later was. He grew up in a very, very cold part of Alaska.
Yep.
Several times as we've seen new forces come here thinking about the Arctic, it could be special forces, it could be a Navy SEAL unit type groups and so forth. We have said, work with the people who live here.
Yeah.
Work with the people who deal with this kind of climate and all the time. Work with the people who know how to do shelter in the north. And one of the very cool things that we've got going on right now, we're building a port in Cordova, the native village of Iak is. And they are bringing military units from all over the country to help on the construction, but also learning about Alaska as they do that. It's the Innovative Readiness Training Program. They may well be helping with, they've helped in Kodiak, in Western Kodiak, and they may be helping out in Adak as well. But we have local knowledge.
Yes.
And that's
people
one place
thrived.
Alaskans can help.
Yeah.
The challenges the military has, say, on radios and batteries, those are our challenges too. So we're working on that. So technologically, you know, what might be done for better equipping the warfighter are things that we deal with every day. And so one of the best things about the Stevens Center being here is to wear down those boundaries.
Well, and as you mentioned, people who have lived in the Arctic for generations have thrived there in extreme environment. And one of the things Captain Vo with the 11th Airborne Able Company said was someone brought a pair of sealskin gloves.
It's
and
huge.
He said they were heavier than the high-tech Army gloves, he said, but they were actually quite a bit warmer. So some of that technology that goes back thousands of years is still with us. I have one last question for you in just about 2 minutes here, sir.
Sure.
Oil shipping in the Arctic has increased dramatically. You have direct experience in mitigating oil disasters. You were Cordova's director of oil spill response after the Exxon Valdez ran aground in 1989. There's little infrastructure and emergency response in the Arctic currently. What are your thoughts about the uptick in oil moving through that region?
Well, here's a statistic, and I wish I had the numbers for you, but somebody attached to the Alaska Marine Exchange said to us the other day, there's more oil moving through the Bering Strait and from Canada across the North Pacific to Asia than there is being shipped from Valdez down the lower 48. The oil spill response capability that we've got in Prince William Sound, which costs well over $100 million a year, towers above what is this greater capability that we've seen accidents like the Selandang Ayu, we've seen accidents like these battery ships breaking up and thousands of cars being dumped into the North Pacific. We need better oil and marine casualty response capability in the North Pacific. And Congress did ask the Coast Guard to up the standards. And we're working with coastal tribes on that to see if make sure that the standards were weaker because we were afraid that it would make it very hard to deliver fuel to Alaska villages when we wrote the oil spill laws in 1990. Now they're saying upgrade them. And I think we can do what our part is in the communities to reduce risk, but we've got to go after those big ships up there. And knowing what they are, where they're going, you can take a look at Russian LNG ships on the, say, marine traffic, and they won't tell you their destination right now. You can, you've got Russian oil moving out of Verende to China. You've got Canadian oil because, you know, whatever you thought about the Keystone Pipeline, the Canadians responded and said, if we can't sell that oil in the United States, we're going to sell it to Asia. So they built a bigger pipeline to Vancouver, and it's going right past our front door. That is something that we need to pay attention to, and it's a security issue as well as an environmental issue.
Well, thank you so much to our guest today, retired Air Force Major General Randy Key, the director of the Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies at Jay Bear, and former Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, the past chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and a senior fellow at the Institute of the North. Thanks to our engineer, Crystal Hyde, our producer is Emily Messner, our editor is Annie Feit, and on the phones, Ava White helped us out today. Join us next week when we run a repeat show on the recent release of the Alaska Literary Field Guide. It was a fun program, and you can hear it again next Tuesday. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening this week. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.